Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Frances Gauthier from Stradley, Ronan, Stevens & Young, representing the appellant below, appellee, Sun Life Assurance Company of Canada, U.S. With me today is my colleague, Carl Myers, who has been admitted pro hoc vici and will be presenting our argument today.
Welcome to the Court, Mr. Myers.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Davis-Oliva, and I'm here pro bono representing the Insurance Commissioner for the State of Delaware. At counsel table with me is Deputy Attorney General James Ropp. He is the General Counsel for the Insurance Commissioner. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal if possible.
You say you're here pro bono. Are you not a Deputy Attorney General any longer?
No, sir. After briefing, I have moved on. I'm General Counsel of a local health company in Delaware.
Ma'am. Thank you for your continued service.
Thank you for hearing me here today, sir. I'd just like to briefly outline the contours of the case, and then I'm going to take a seat, if that's okay with the Court, and respond to argument. This case is a quite simple case. We presented the case as stipulated facts, so there's no dispute about what the underlying facts are. This case is a debate about the process of statutory construction, as outlined by this court and the law and in the courts of the state, and how we construe plain meaning in a statute. The insurance commissioner's position is that the hearing officer got it right. He went through a two-step process that this court's outlined in numerous cases, recently in DePasquale and Stolt Management, which says when there's a conflict about the meaning of a statute, the first thing and only thing that a court construing that statute is supposed to do is look at the four corners of the statutory language at issue. Supposed to look at the entire statute, not just a small piece of it, but they're just supposed to look at the statute.
Tell us what the legal issue is so that we can put your comments in context.
Yes, Your Honor. The legal issue here is that under the Delaware General Insurance Premium Tax Statute, which is 18 Delaware Code 702, there's a provision that gives a reduced, graduated, tier-by-tier premium tax rate to certain kinds of policies. That section defines those policies as cases. And the dispute here is whether a case, which is defined as, amongst other things, it was defined in 1994 as a single private placement. It was amended in 1998 to say a private placement. And the question now before the court is, does that really mean a as in one private placement, which is the insurance commissioner's position, or does that A mean, as Sun Life has argued, any, which doesn't really get us very far because any is also an indefinite article that can be construed to mean in context one or all. So ultimately what their position is, even though they argue in the briefs that we're just trying to say that it means any, not all, they mean all. They mean all inclusive. What Sun Life did after the amendments was they issued seven separate COLI policies under seven separate Regulation D private placements. So those specific insurance policies, which is that Exhibit D,
Before the amendment, the statute read a single private placement.
That's right. In fact, what's really...
Yes, all right. Right?
That's correct.
After the amendment, it was amended to read a private placement, deleting the word single.
Correct.
Would it be fair then to characterize the issue as whether the language, quote, a private placement, means something materially different from, quote, a single private placement?
I think that that's another way to look at it if you want to go back and look at the fact that the statutory language has even changed. The commissioner's initial position is that if you just look at the four corners of the statute as written, you don't need to go into that secondary analysis, and here's why. The statute as written under 702C2 uses the word a or an three times. It says it's an employer again, and that's in section C2-1A. And then in the B section, which is what we're actually talking about here, it uses a again before private placement. In the 1994 version of the statute, all of those a's and an's had single after them before the noun that it modified.
I'm just trying to see if everybody agrees on what it is we're supposed to decide. Was my statement of the issue incorrect or correct?
The material change canon is a canon that looks back to see if the statute's been changed. My primary argument would be that the statute on its face, as written, has to conform to the commissioner's construction because the words all, plural words are used with plural nouns after them, plural modifiers and plural nouns, in the same subsection. And singular modifiers and singular nouns are used in the same subsection. And as we argued in our brief...
Your argument is, yes, there was an amendment,
yes,
but it didn't really change anything
correct.
Material.
That's correct, sir. For the very reason I'm telling you is that single wasn't just... it's that issue is obscured, I think, in Sun Life's brief, in all fairness, to opposing counsel for a reason.
All right. So the critical issue, or at least the threshold issue, is was there a material change affected by the amendment, whatever that may mean?
I have to agree with that comment because if there isn't a material change, there's no canon for them to rely
on. And the trial court found that there was a material change and then went on and ruled oppositely to the commissioner, correct?
That's what happened. I mean, I would characterize what the process that the Superior Court went through a little differently because the Superior Court didn't do any plain meaning analysis at all.
Well, tell me, what, if anything, was accomplished by the 1998 amendment? You know, just putting aside taxes and things like that, what was different after the amendment in any respect?
If you look at it, not much. I mean, it says technical, the synopsis is quite honest, actually. It says technical and positional changes are all we're making. And what they did was they struck the word single literally three times from the statute. Instead of having it in one bulk section, they broke out an A and B, and that made them add an all, but that all was already modifying contracts before as it was. The purpose of that was to make it very clear that one thing could occur under 1035 swaps, et cetera, that a group of small employers could collaborate and do a single private placement together so that they had enough assets and resources to qualify, and that they would get the same treatment as a really large company that had enough employees to benefit from a policy like this in the first instance.
To accomplish that, did they have to eliminate the word single?
I don't think they needed to eliminate the word single, and I also, in my humble opinion, do not believe they needed to eliminate the word a group of employers and change that to all employers, but they did that as well.
So, see, that's the difficulty we're having. They've amended the statute, and they've taken out some words. And you're arguing that after the statute was amended and the words were removed, the statute after 1998 basically meant exactly what it said before 1994. So the effect of the amendment was just no change.
No change, or as the legislature said, in the little tiny bit that we have from the legislature, you know, technical changes to sort of clarify.
Technical versus substantive.
Yes,
right?
Sir. And so what they thought was these words are superfluous. We've seen that the General Assembly does that sometimes. Something's overwritten and someone comes in and says, let's clean this up while we're doing other things.
Okay.
They went into the statute to do something else, the 1035 right. swap, so they cleaned this up, made this a little more streamlined.
And if I understand you correctly, your claim, your contention, is that we can arrive at the conclusion you want us to reach by just simply looking at the 1998 statutory language. That is, on its face, it conveys the same substantive meaning as the 1994 statutory language.
That's correct, and we went one step further and sort of went down. If you don't construe it that way, what happens? What happens is...
Okay, but
yes,
that's
sir.
That's one source, is
yes,
the, just the face of the statute.
Yes, sir.
Is there any other... source of information that we can look to arrive at the result that you claim we should reach?
I think there's numerous other sources. One is that if you actually construe this to have different meaning, and specifically because what I need to respond to is the meaning that they've imported into the word A, you eliminate the first section of the statute. If you change A or an, if it really means in this entire subsection of this little subsection of the statute, if A and an really, because single was struck in those sections as well, it said an, a single employer. It now says an employer.
Well, help me understand something else. You mentioned in 1035 of the Internal Revenue Code, On page 13 of the Superior Court's opinion, in responding to this similar argument, it said, you know, the commissioner's looking at 702C2B and making a comparison or reference to 1035, but what they wanted to do with regard to 1035, they did somewhere else. What's the Superior Court trying to say there?
The 1035, the court was not responsive to that argument, and I think that if I tell you what the argument is, maybe it'll make more sense, sir. The Supreme Court's trying to say that the actual 1035 modifying language was in a different section.
That's the way I read it.
And that's exactly correct. Actual modifying language. But the definitions of what we are going to exempt out matter too. They're not mutually exclusive. And what happens here is that in order to qualify for a 1035 swap, which is what employers want, for all kinds of reasons I don't need to explain to this court, but rate changes and things like that.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've had one of these cases before. Didn't involve Delaware law, but we learned a lot about these.
Yes, sir. And but it's fairly straightforward on its face insofar as it's got to be the same insured. And we hear no COLI policies, or that's the company. And we know it has to be the same beneficiary, et cetera, or else you can't qualify for the swap. That's the reason why Sun Life, from an employer-driven perspective, a consumer-driven perspective, did these as separate placements.
No, I understand that. But just tell me as directly as you can, if the goal relates to something tied to 1035, and you need to do it in another part of the Delaware Code, why we're still looking at these changes in 1998 to connect us to 1035. And what you're saying is somehow the other part of the code incorporates 702 by reference?
It just defines what a qualified COLI policy is. It doesn't define the word case.
So then it really doesn't tell us too much about the elimination of the word single that appeared three times.
Not much. All that I think that you can say in fairness that it tells you is that the word, the definition of case in that B section does try to conform to what would qualify as a 1035 policy by saying a single private placement, which is the Reg D exception, or, you know, greater than 25 people, et cetera. It doesn't conflict.
Now, one of the things in the briefs, just talking generally again, and we're told the purpose of this was to make Delaware a more attractive place for this type of arrangement. And I understand your earlier argument to say what they really did to make Delaware more attractive was simply allow small people to get together in a group, and that you couldn't do that in other states, or was there some other reason, or that maybe not be the reason? So why was Delaware more attractive?
Delaware is the only state in the entire nation that we've found, and we've continued to look at this as this litigation has gone on for years and years and years, that allows two things, and that is to allow COLI policies to be treated differently than any other net premiums. The net premiums under 702C1 in this statute are taxed at 1.75%, period. Then the second section that we're talking about says, in lieu of that, you meet the definition of case, instead of just paying a flat 1.75, here's what you can do. On the first $10 million, you pay 2%. On the 10 to $25 million, you pay 1.75, they go down to 1%. And so that's a graduated benefit, and why is that? Well, the larger the policy is, the lower the tax rate is that you get. So really big companies ought to want to come to Delaware and do this because they're going to reap the benefits of it because they write such large policies. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that there's a sentence right after that that says, and by the way, you're never going to go back to the high rate again if it's still the same case. So if I got myself down in this year to 1.5 because I wrote $25 million worth of insurance, I'm going to maintain that the next year. That does not revert back. So those two examples do not exist anywhere else in American law that we can find, and they're excellent savings for insurance companies.
So this is a hypothetical, but if we look at this case, then if $10 million was the trigger at a higher rate, and then when you got above $10 million, you got to the lower rate, clearly from the commissioner's point of view, you'd rather have seven $10 million policies at the higher rate than one $70 million policy that would implicate the lower rates for the other policies.
That's precisely right, and it makes simple math sense. And if you do look at the sparse legislative history here, to the extent that this honorable court thinks it's relevant, one of the interesting things that happened in this very short debate about this bill in 1994, they called the comptroller in the legislature did and said, is this really going to be the big shebang? Are we really going to, you know, reap, you know, everybody's going to come here and write these huge policies? And he said, I think we'll make some money off of it, but I think you guys are sort of overestimating how lucrative this is going to be for Delaware. None of that stuff happened in 1998. I mean, in Delaware practice, and I don't need to tell this court, if they were going to, as the statute was static in 1994 and it already had these two benefits in it, if they were going to modify the statute to allow people to aggregate their private placements, we would have had a fiscal note attached to that bill. I mean, that would have been a huge projected loss for the insurance department the next year. There's no question about that. And I'm certain that since they called the comptroller in on what sounded like excellent news in 1994, a sure loss in 1998 would have triggered at least some of those concerns. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Your argument rendering one of the previous sections of the statute is surplusage or meaningless. Was that addressed by the trial court?
No, it was argued but not addressed. It is in the administrative decision from the hearing officer, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon again, Mr. Myers.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good afternoon. I just want to say it's my privilege to practice before this court. My name is Carl Myers, and I'm with the law firm Stradley, Ronan, Stevens & Young, with offices in Wilmington. I guess I'd like to start by speaking directly to the issue that Justice Holland, you raised a few minutes ago about the 1998 changes being, I'm quoting it correctly, as implementing no change whatsoever. That's, in a nutshell, that's really the department's position, that the 1998 changes to the statute, it's as if they never happened. So if this court were to read the statute the way the department wants the court to read it, it will effectively have to nullify the 1998 amendments.
Well, yes, you seem to be suggesting that the General Assembly doesn't have the authority to clean up a piece of legislation and make some housekeeping changes without modifying the meaning of the statute.
Certainly, Justice Berger, they absolutely do have that right, and they have done it on occasion. I submit, though, with the changes made here in 1998, they were not simply housekeeping items. They weren't simply cleanup items. In particular, the word that has been honed in on here, the word single, that's the pivot upon which the 1994 version of the statute turned. That was the fulcrum. Basically, because of the word single, you had each individual policy issued to a trust, to an employer, to an individual, and pursuant to a private placement. They were each a case, based on the use of the word single. When the word single was deleted, that removed that pivot, that removed that limitation. So the insurers were left with four categories, four buckets, the employers, trusts, individuals, and private placements bucket. So while, of course, a legislature is entitled to clean up its statute, this was a material change. I mean, this the word single is crucial in the statute.
Well, you say that it's crucial. But doesn't the synopsis say that they were making technical changes?
It does. It does.
And doesn't that suggest that the General Assembly didn't think that taking those words out was crucial, as you say?
They didn't see it as a watershed event, which I submit the 1994 version of the statute, which implemented this favorable COLI taxation, that was a watershed event because that gave favorable premium taxation to COLI policies. The 1998 amendments, you're not seeing that legislative history. We don't know exactly why. Of course, you know, you don't know what's going on in the heads of individual legislators. But I submit that the changes aren't the earth-shattering change that the department would have the court believe. While, of course, there's a fiscal impact associated with broadening what a case is, the reality is that, and we've set this forth in our brief, and this is a function of the dollars we're talking about. COLI policies are very large dollar policies. So the slightest change in percentage is going to have a significant, to the average person, dollars impact. But the effective tax rate difference, as we calculate it under the 1998 policy versus how, or under the 1998 statute versus how the department calculates it, is actually an effective tax rate difference of only 0.23%. So I would submit that is reflective of the General Assembly's understanding that they were really affecting an incremental change to the statute. not a watershed or earth-shattering change to the statute.
But there's a difference between saying we are making a minor modification and saying we are making technical changes. Technical implies that there is no substantive change going on here.
That is true, but I would submit that just because you have a synopsis that says technical changes, it's not necessarily true that that language in the synopsis is speaking to the entire statute.
Well, your contention is that whatever the change was in 1998, it wasn't a material change.
I'm sorry, Justice Jacobs. It's our position it was a material change.
I'm sorry, it was a material
change. It was a material change
okay.
in the statute, yes.
And
okay, so material that it took your client 4 years for the light bulb to go on?
Well, we don't have a record of that, and I can't make a representation to the court about exactly how it came about, but I can say...
I didn't ask that, but
somebody realized
it did take 4 years for that the materiality of that change to become apparent.
It took some time. Somebody, I think what happened was somebody realized that they were filing taxes incorrectly and went back and asked for an amendment. And that's, frankly, that's why you have an amendment process for tax returns, because...
It's being argued here... And I understand that it was argued in the Superior Court that if the your client's construction of the 1998 amendment were accepted, that it would render a provision, I guess it would be subsection C2B, meaningless and surplusage. And you conceded that.
Oh, no, that's not correct at all. Let me explain what has been done with the surplus issue.
You were quoted, and you said, well, if the construction renders the statute surpluses, so what?
Yeah, and we were quoted out of context from the Superior Court argument. The question that was put to present counsel was, if your reading of the statute requires us to read surplus into the statute, what am I, Judge Carpenter, to do about that issue? And my response was consistent with separation of powers, that if the statute is deemed to be written in an awkward fashion, if it is deemed to have surplus, if it could be written better or if this court would prefer a better construction, that that's a fix for the legislature to make and for it to amend the statute to clean it up and if there's surplus to remove that surplus.
So you were conceding that it may well be.
It could be.
It could be surplus.
It could be surplus, but I want to sort of pump the brakes on that issue because under the statute as we construe it, we give effect to the language from start to finish. The way we construe the statute, there are four buckets. There's a case for employers, for trusts, for individuals and private placements. That gives full effect to the statute. It doesn't render any of those provisions or any of those portions to be surplus.
Well, I'm reluctant to ask a question that uses the word any, all, or a, but disregard that part of my question. But as I understand it, going back to what I said to your colleague, if we hypothetically had seven policies at $10 million and they were all taxed at a higher rate, but the change, according to you in the statute, is that you have $70 million in private placements and the $70 million implicate the lower rate, technical is kind of in the eye of the beholder. As I understand the argument in your brief is that, yeah, technically there was a change, and it does put all of the private placements together. But from the state's perspective, if you can go up to $200 million, to take an example, even though you're at the lower rate, the fact that you have more means you have more money, even though you're getting it at the lower rate when we look at it in absolute terms.
I think that's correct. And actually, that's the fact that the effect of the 1998 amendments would allow an insurer to more speedily achieve the 1% threshold. I submit that that's simply a function of the fact that that's how the legislature changed the statute.
And they were in the next argument, the extension of that argument would be, and the legislature was happy because once you reach the threshold, if you issued a lot more policies, even though it would be taxed at the lower rate, at the end of the day, it would be more money.
Absolutely, absolutely. Whether it's 1% or 1.1 or 1.2, that's dollars coming into the fisc of the state of Delaware. And if you look, it actually played out in this case. It played out with Sun Life. If you look at attached to, I think, at least two of the tax returns here, and we provide references in our brief to these, we appended to our tax returns for the state of Delaware, as you have to, a table listing premium dollars in each state. Delaware is, I think, 1, 2, or 3 in each of those years in terms of premium dollars. So the exact policy that the Delaware General Assembly was trying to implement in 1994, and we contend was incrementally carrying forward in 1998, was achieved. Those tax dollars were brought into the state of Delaware. They got the Delaware General Assembly got the bigger piece of the premium pie, at least as a Sun Life, that it was looking for. So the program between 94 and 98 was a success. I think that's the way that we should be looking at it. I did want to address a number of matters that were raised by my learned adversary. One of the issues was the contention that Judge Carpenter didn't engage in any plain meaning analysis. And I'll point the court's attention to Judge Carpenter's opinion at page 10, where he says, at times legislative intent can be gleaned from the statute itself and its underlying purpose. Furthermore, the Delaware Code indicates that words and phrases shall be read with their context and shall be construed according to the common and approved usage. And he cites, Judge Carpenter cites, this court's cases and Delaware statute for those principles. So I think the notion that Judge Carpenter didn't know how to interpret the statute and didn't understand a plain meaning. Yes?
Well, it is correct, is it not, that Judge Carpenter led off his analysis with a determination that the 1998 amendment was a material change from the 1994 statute.
He
is
did,
that correct?
Correct. And
is there anywhere any analysis as to how he got to that conclusion?
There is analysis. The analysis that he provided was that he, as I read Judge Carpenter's opinion, his understanding was that the 1994 version of the statute was plain and understandable on its face, a single private placement, no doubt about that meaning. But his conclusion was that when the statute was changed in 1998, and you could view this, the 1998 change in a vacuum, that the 1998 version was not plain and unambiguous on its face.
And that's it?
Well, and that was...
Ergo, there was a material change?
Well, he went on beyond that and then described the single change, as I have described it, as an important component of the statute, and it was a material change. But my point was that while there may be quibbles with the order in which Judge Carpenter addressed the issues, the fact of the matter is that he did look at the plain meaning of the statute, and he decided that it was ambiguous. I think it's, frankly, more of a quibble with the form of opinion writing. And as the court well knows, jurists are permitted to write opinions in whatever fashion they deem appropriate, assuming it complies, of course, with
So basically the substance or sum and substance of Judge Carpenter's analysis was 1994, the statute read a single private placement. 1998, it reads a private placement. I find that a private placement is not as crystal clear as a single private placement, therefore there's ambiguity, which requires a construction in favor of the insurer.
I think that's one way it could be read. I think that he did view the 1998 version of the statute in isolation, that he did view that as ambiguous on its own 2 feet without not necessarily resorting to the 1994 version of the statute. But even beyond that, I think having reached
But there was no textual analysis other than that conclusion?
I believe he read the statute as it was, and then he decided that it was ambiguous on his face. But with that as background, I think given that Judge Carpenter found that the 1998 version of the statute was ambiguous, he was required, as this court's precedents required with the Acadia Brandywine case and all the way back to the Consolidated Fisheries case, it was required to construe the statute in favor of Sun Life. And that's because this court has a longstanding rule that if a taxing statute is deemed ambiguous or if there's doubt about its breadth, I think that's the language from the Consolidated Fisheries case, then it had to be construed in favor of the taxpayer. And the fundamental principle that underlies that is taxpayer notice. And so here, Judge Carpenter was sort of wrangling and wringing his hands a little bit about the meaning of the statute. I think that in and of itself shows that the statute, it could be clear, it could be more plain on its face. And so he sort of threw up his hands.
I'm really trying to find out what rule of law the finding of a material change was anchored. Because there doesn't seem to be any. It just seems to be, you know, it's like pornography. I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it.
I don't know that Judge Carpenter provided a citation. I don't think he did provide a citation or a case that distinguishes a material from an immaterial statutory change. And I don't know that there's any Delaware authorities that speak to that specific point. That maybe that was what was why he was struggling to come.
Well, I think we're talking about, as Justice Berger alluded to, and Justice Hung, the difference between a technical change and one of substance.
Right, right.
And basically, he's saying there was a substantive change.
Correct.
And my question is, in what way?
Well, in the way that the deleting
that
the word
is,
single.
How come?
Right, and deleting the word single from the statute is simply not a technical change. I submit that I don't understand how the statute could have been cleaned up or made clearer by deleting the word single. I don't think there's a clearer word than single. If you're going to confine...
There's an order of magnitude difference between a private placement and a single private placement?
There's a difference. I'm not sure I follow, Your Honor, in terms of an order of magnitude. I think it changes the meaning of the statutory language.
Qualitative?
A qualitative difference, yes, Your Honor. I believe there is. Because when you have a statute like this one, which was not only amended to delete the word single, but there's predecessor language. Obviously, we have to read the statute in context. We can't take the word, the phrase a private placement out of context. That phraseology is preceded by two uses of the word all. And as my learned adversary has indicated, the word a is a context-dependent word. We agree with that. But the context here is that when you have two preceding uses of the word all, it expresses a linguistic intent to capture the universe of the particular subject in question. So it's our position that when you say all contracts issued to all employers and trusts pursuant to a private placement, that you're trying to capture the universe of private placements in that language. At least that's the plain reading of the statute as we see it.
Well, if we put aside all of the posturing, the law seems to be that the court looks at the language in the statute. And to the extent it was characterized in the synopsis as a technical change, if there was a substantive change, notwithstanding the fact that the substance that the synopsis characterized it as technical, you have to go by whatever passed the legislature. And it's also possible that someone thought they were making a technical change and it had unintended consequences, or they didn't think through all the ramifications. So at the end of the day, we really still have to focus on the language in the statute, don't we?
I agree. We do have to focus on the language in the statute, and, of course, that's fundamental to the court's task. Obviously, the synopsis is one on control. And I would add, I would hasten to add to Justice Holland, to your point, that the synopsis in question, I believe, says some language about the IRS changes for 1035 exchanges, and then it says, and makes other technical and position changes. It doesn't say every other change we've made here is for technical and technical reasons. It says we make other changes. So the synopsis doesn't say on its face that it's addressed to the entirety of the statute. So it could very well be that the synopsis just doesn't speak to this issue at all that we're dealing with here today, and I think that's likely the case. And while I'm on the subject, I did want to just dispense with this 1035 issue. The 1035 exchange issue has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. The 1035 implementation that was brought about by the 1998 version of the statute, that's contained in Section 2 of the legislation from 1998. That changed, I believe it's Title 18, Section 2704. It added subsection E1. What we're dealing with here is 702, which is the premiums tax statute. That was in Section 1 of the 1998 legislation. So there's a dividing line between the two, and nothing about the changes that were brought about in 1998, as I understand it, helped implement the 1035 changes at all.
One of the concerns that I have is that the analysis, the statutory analysis that the trial court engaged in may have been too narrow. And I say that or suggest that because I think by your own concession, the construction that your side advocated and the Superior Court adopted could render as surplusage and meaningless Section 702 C2B. It appears that although that issue was argued to the trial court, it wasn't addressed at all in the opinion. And my question is, shouldn't, you know, the the possibility that that construction of the statute could create that problem, which would then require a legislative fix, have been taken into account in the analysis as to what the proper interpretation of the statute should be?
I don't know, without going back and looking at the department's brief in the Superior Court, I don't know that the surpluses issue was, there was that much time spent on that issue. So that may be a reason why Judge Carper didn't address it.
You're saying it wasn't properly raised?
No, it may have been raised, but I don't know if it was raised in a great deal of depth. And perhaps that is why Judge Carpenter decided not to spend much of any time on it.
And perhaps not, but perhaps it's not there. And
right.
The court adopted reading of the statute that well could cause problems in a different part of the statutory universe.
Right. I understand, Justice Berger. I think, or I'm sorry, Justice Jacobs. The issue, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought, is
My concern is that if that is a problem, shouldn't it be addressed
right.
as part of the analysis, and it wasn't here?
It wasn't here, but I don't think that poses a stumbling block for this court's analysis. I think our reading of the statute gives effect to the full extent of the statute. But if to the extent the court decides that there is surplusage or that it has to read the court such that a surplusage, and that's why I said so be it below, because the court has to take the statute as it finds it.
Thank you.
I'm out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Just a couple comments. The first issue was addressed in the commissioner's reply brief, but Sun Life is consistently represented. I'm not quite sure why, because the math doesn't add up, that this is a material change, but it's not that big of a deal because it's only 0.23%. That's false. I don't need to explain to this court that if Sun Life owes between $3.5 and $4 million in premium tax and they're asking for an $850,000 refund, we're talking about 25%. It's a 23% difference, not a 0.23% difference. That is a gross underestimation. And that's critically important to the commissioner because what we're talking about here is how much of a gain this reading is for insurance companies. It's over $365,000 per case. That they would get a discount from if it was constructed their way versus ours. That adds up to really big dollars over time. We don't believe the General Assembly would have done this and then called it technical or positional changes to the extent that opposing counsel's argument is that we don't think this addresses the changes at all. That just doesn't make any sense given what happened here. They struck single three times because they thought it was surplusage when you already had an A or an and. They left the noun that it modified singular. And in that same section, they used the word all three times. So their construction would require this court to do two things that this court has never done. Construe two dramatically different words in the statute to mean the exact same thing and imply, in so doing, that the General Assembly didn't know the difference between the word all and the word a. This court's never done anything like that. That's counterintuitive. And second,
well, how do we resolve the philosophical debate that you just alluded to about what the commissioner's interest is and what the General Assembly wanted to do? Because you find many times where taxes are reduced to create an economic incentive to generate more tax revenue.
And I think that the General Assembly would have said something about that, just like they did in 1994 and just like they do when they do tax reduction statutes as a general rule. They wouldn't have ever called it a technical or positional change. A positional change is another thing that actually happened in this very provision. It used to be in one block. It's so tedious, I hate to bring this up, but it used to be in one block paragraph, and now it's A, B. They rearranged how the statute was written as well. That's what they mean. And that's all that they said that they did. And we have to take them on their face value. Why would you even say a sentence, technical and positional changes, and then say millions of dollars in tax savings for insurance companies, and we're not going to advertise that? And I think...
Well, that, again, depending on what they wanted to do. There may have been millions of dollars in tax savings for insurance companies, but it was offset by millions of dollars in revenue for the state of Delaware.
And my counter argument to that would be if the General Assembly wanted to do that, it simply needs subsection A and the construction that they would apply to the word A. And stuff. You don't even need to rewrite the subsection or have it at all, because all contracts, all employers, subsection A covers the universe.
And, you know, our questions aren't arguments. All we're trying to do,
I mean, it just
doesn't figure it out.
Yeah, I would say they would have had us, if they were intending to do that, they would have, I mean, those two provisions are neck and they're right beside each other. They broke them out. They reordered them. They were certainly looking at them. They struck the word single.
Well, we don't have any record one way or the other as to whether the state was the state treasury was a net winner or a net loser as a result of these 1998 amendments, do we?
What we can tell you is that the state treasury would be a net loser now because this.
Well sure, now they'd have to refund the money, but we don't know net whether the change generated more revenue, notwithstanding this refund.
We know, Your Honor, that the change didn't generate more revenue because we know that no other insurance company read the statute this way. Nobody else in the world believed that this was the appropriate construction of the statute, including this very company for the first 5 years the statute was on the books with their tax lawyers. No other insurance company has applied for this refund. No one has asked for it. The insurance companies didn't advertise, here we go, let's go to Delaware. That didn't happen. In fact, Sun Life themselves have written less policies in Delaware since the 1998 amendments, not more. And that's in the administrative record. They were asked that by the hearing officer below. If this is having an impact on them. But we did put in there, Mike Rich, who was representing the department at the time, testified and said there's 18 to 20 insurers in Delaware do this right now. No one has taken this position on the statute.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, sir.
The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.